Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. It's been a while since I looked at anything put out by Answers in Genesis proper, but I've mostly been focusing on their Canadian wing for the last little while. So I found this video where Dr. Georgia Purdom claims that science confirms Noah's Ark and the Flood. I wonder if she'll get into the genetics. She has a PhD in molecular genetics, so she's definitely qualified, but one of the things I've noticed from watching Answers News is that often they will discuss genetic matters when she is not there and avoid them when she is, which makes me suspect that she's got at least enough integrity to not let them get away with misrepresenting genetics, so instead of having her accidentally debunking them, they just avoid her area of expertise when she's around. Now, I could very well be wrong on this, I haven't exactly watched every last episode of Answers News, but from what I have seen, that's the impression I got. Now, this video is a lecture that's over an hour long, so I'll be skipping quite a bit. As always, the link to the original video is in the description, so you can go watch it yourself to make sure I'm not pulling any context shenanigans. Let's go!
Five things Kentucky could spend $73 million on today by fake Noah's Ark. Now here's the thing, Kentucky didn't spend a dime.
That's not really relevant to the science that actually completely disproves Noah's Ark. She's just opening by playing the persecution card. Lots of news outlets ran negative stories about us building a $100 million landlocked boat that once suffered flood damage, so here's proof that we're being persecuted. I just wanted to touch on her saying that Kentucky didn't spend a dime, because, well, technically true, it's not actually true. Kentucky gave up a lot of tax revenue that they would have gotten from the Ark if Answers in Genesis hadn't been playing tax games and trying desperately to avoid paying taxes, which included things like selling the park from a for-profit organization to a not-for-profit organization for $10 when it was announced that the city of Williamstown would be instituting a 50-cent per ticket safety fee that would go toward things like fire and police services. Then, when they learned that this transfer would get them out of a deal that would have them avoiding $18 million in taxes, they transferred it back to the for-profit organization in order to avoid losing out on those tax breaks. So while that headline was indeed misleading, at the time it was written, $73 million was the estimated cost to build the Ark total, not what they would avoid paying in taxes, the avoidance of taxes is essentially the same as the government paying for something. Think of it like wage theft. If an employee works for a company for $15 an hour and is asked to work for an hour without being paid, then that is effectively that employee paying their employer $15, but in labor instead of money. So when the Ark Encounter doesn't pay taxes that it would normally have to pay without its special deals, that is effectively the government subsidizing them in the amount of whatever taxes they have avoided paying. That's actually the whole point of tax incentives for businesses. The business is supposed to help the economy in exchange for paying less tax, so the government gives up a certain amount of tax revenue in the hopes of being able to make it up through other taxes that come from having a booming economy. And this will end the Arkonomics portion of the video. I just wanted to get that out of the way.
And this is about 1,500 years after creation. And we really see, I think the Bible sums up for us the horrible and tragic effects of Adam's sin. This has been about 1,500 years worth of it. It says, "And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually."
Yep, it does say that. And we know that that, at the very least, has to be hyperbole. Why? Well, because I can't think of anything that would be more exhausting than only having thoughts that had some form of morality attached to them. You're not allowed to think just, "I'm tired." You have to think more along the lines of, "I'm tired because of all the murdering I've been doing." Because just thinking "I'm tired" is neither moral nor immoral. It is entirely amoral. And how does one really want to go to bed, but evilly? And these sorts of amoral thoughts occupy a huge part of your day. So this verse cannot be literally true. But also, after the flood, God basically admitted that it didn't fix anything. After the flood in Genesis 8, God promises not to flood everyone to death again because it didn't actually fix anything. Mankind is still evil.
So the first one is, how big was the ark? Now, like I said, many of us have become accustomed to images of the ark that look like this one.
Of course, it wouldn't be an Answers in Genesis flood video if they didn't take a moment to shit on cartoon ark representations. It's like they think that as kids grow up, they continue to assume that everything they saw in kids' books were completely accurate representations of reality. There really is a family of bears that drive around in a red convertible. How about that? And as much as I like the scientifically accurate books to read to the kids, I have no problem with the fact that a lot of the even scientific books contain a degree of whimsy in them. And I like to think that my kids, and actually most kids, are smart enough to figure out that kids' books are never 100% accurate to reality. Except for I Need a New Butt. That book is 100% nonfiction biography.
Christians are doing this, okay? Christians are portraying the ark like this. We're not, but a lot of Christians are. And here's the problem. The world mocks us, right? What mocks us? And we have the biblical ark, the biblically sized one.
Yeah, we mock you even with your biblically sized ark, because the biblically sized ark is still way too small to accomplish the job that it's supposed to have accomplished. It has inadequate ventilation, so everything on the ark would have died of methane poisoning. And despite its small size for its job, it's still way too big to have been seaworthy as a ship made of wood. And that's just a couple of the problems that it has. So yes, we mock people that take the Ark seriously because AIG's version of the Ark is no better than the children's book versions. And even if you could get every single children's book publisher to stop publishing the cartoon Ark and publish yours instead, we'd still mock you.
But the world mocks Christians and says, ha ha, how can this be true? Well, no wonder, if this is what they think we think the ark looked like.
Yeah, nobody looks at children's book arcs and thinks that that's what Christians actually think the real ark was. Now, do we sometimes use that imagery to enhance the silliness that is the Noah's Ark story? Absolutely. But you guys are wasting a lot of time and resources trying to fight against something that is a non-issue at worst. Which is fine. Continue wasting resources on ineffective things. I really don't mind. My main issue is that you have those resources to begin with, but as long as you do have them, I'd rather they go toward things that have no impact on anything, like fighting against kids' book arcs.
I don't blame them for making fun of us, okay? I mean, they have a right to if that's the way we portray the arc, and that's the way we portray this event. I see why they're making fun of us, because there's no way this is going to survive a year-long catastrophic flood.
I mean, you're correct, but there's also no way that the ark that you guys built would survive a year-long catastrophic flood. I mean, if you had actually built it as a boat with the intention of being put to sea at some point. Honestly, I'd like to see AIG do that sometime. Instead of building a museum shaped like an ark, but with buildings and iron trusses and modern ventilation systems and all sorts of other infrastructure that Noah wouldn't have had access to, how about you build an actual seaworthy vessel to the specifications laid out in the Bible, using only what Noah would have had available to him? That would be far more impressive. You could even turn it into a money-making cruise of sorts, if you can figure out how to steer it while staying true to the biblical specifications. Show that an ark of biblical proportions is actually possible and seaworthy, and then maybe we'll stop making fun of you every time you do something like submit insurance claims for flood damage. Yes, I know the flood damage was to a walkway on the property rather than the actual boat building, but the irony is still delicious.
And so if we do a little bit of math here, we can figure this out, that its length was 510 feet, its width was 85 feet, and its height was 51 feet.
The longest confirmed wooden ship to ever be built in history was the schooner Wyoming, which was 450 feet long, including the booms that stretched out both in front of and behind it, which added about 100 feet to its length, with the upper deck being about 350 feet. So if we're limiting ourselves to the parts of the ship that would actually have been in the water, the Wyoming was 160 feet shorter than Noah's Ark. And to quote the Wikipedia page, because of her extreme length and wood construction, Wyoming tended to flex in heavy seas, which would cause the long planks to twist and buckle, thereby allowing seawater to intrude into the hold. Wyoming had to use pumps to keep her hold relatively free of water. And on top of these pumps, it had 90 iron cross bracings on each side for a total of 180 iron cross bracings. Did Noah use iron cross bracings for the Ark? The Bible omits that detail if he did. So, did he have pumps to keep the water out of the hold? Again, the Bible's rather silent on the matter. So he built a boat that modern shipbuilders would tell you is not seaworthy, and we're supposed to not laugh at this story or consider it a myth? I mean, I guess you could just say that God kept it afloat with his miracle powers, but given that this talk is titled Science Confirms Noah's Ark and the Flood, appealing to miracle powers when science tells you it's impossible is not a good tactic, so I see why you don't do it.
I've been at the Ark many days when there have been thousands of people there, and it can be kind of weird, almost in some ways, because you can be standing outside the Ark and you think, where is everybody? And it's like, oh, they're on the Ark.
And there's the nod to the fact that the Ark encounter is underperforming compared to what they said their numbers would be when they applied for their tax breaks. They always want to present themselves as having better numbers than they actually do, but thanks to that safety fee, we can see how many tickets they sell each year, and it works out to about 700,000 tickets per year, compared to their projected 1.2 to 2 million for their first year, with a projected 7% annual growth in ticket sales. So yeah, they're not in danger of going bankrupt anytime soon, unfortunately, but they are nowhere near as successful as they want people to think. And remember when I said the Arkonomics portion of the video ended earlier? Yeah, apparently that was a lie. Sorry.
Now, another way to get a sense of its size would be to compare it to boats that have been built in more modern times. We can compare it to the Wyoming.
See, there you go. I was thinking of looking for that very graphic because that demonstrates my point quite nicely. The Ark was smaller than the Titanic and much smaller than a modern cruise ship, so it's not really that big of a boat, but it was significantly larger than the Wyoming, which was barely seaworthy and ended up sinking due to its wooden construction, even with pumps and iron cross bracings. But yeah, not only was the Ark totally seaworthy, it could also hold two of every animal, which, if you use AIG's logic, was at least 16,000 individual animals being cared for by 8 humans, not to mention all their supplies for a year-long voyage. AIG has a zoo that only has about 200 animals in it, and for this tiny number of animals, they have at least 7 zookeepers. So if we keep the ratio of zookeepers to animals the same, then for 16,000 animals on the Ark, there would have to have been about 560 zookeepers. Now, I'm not great at math, but I think that's slightly more than 8.
And research has actually been conducted on the Ark by engineers to understand that its dimensions are actually perfect for a cargo ship. We actually use similar dimensions today for cargo ships.
Okay, first off, that's complete bullshit. The research that found that didn't have adequate information from which to draw those conclusions. They say flat out that they're getting their information about the hull of Noah's Ark from existing references and from modern assumptions of naval engineers. So if you take modern shipbuilding knowledge and apply it to the approximate dimensions of the Ark found in the Bible, also assuming other characteristics that are not made clear by the Bible, like the draft height, then when you test models with several different hull shapes, you find a few that are resistant to capsizing. Even if I grant all that, this does not mean that the boat as a whole would have been seaworthy. Hell, one of their sources of information on the form of the hull were the arguments and references made by those who, quote-unquote, found the Ark on Mount Ararat, a find that Answers in Genesis does not consider to be valid. To get the draft height of the Ark, they just assumed that when Genesis 7:20 says that the water was 15 cubits above the tallest mountain, that can be assumed to be the draft height for the Ark. This whole study, and I use the term study very loosely here, is on incredibly shaky ground. Just to give you an idea of its quality, it was published in the Proceedings of the International Conference on Creation Research. No secular journal would ever publish something like this, not because it supports the Noah's Ark story, but because it just assumes everything that it needs to assume in order to come to its conclusions, with little to no valid reasons for those assumptions. And secondly, and far more important in my opinion, as to that diagram, how exactly does making a long, skinny ship increase comfort? I would think that the comfort you experience on a ship is mostly about stability. The less it feels like it's moving, the more comfortable it is. But you have comfort and stability as two separate categories, so I really want to know how comfortable you think a long, skinny, and unstable ship would be, and why you think a maximally stable ship would be uncomfortable.
Now, there's been further study that's been done on the Ark. There was a study that was actually published in 1993 by Korean scientists who built a scale model of the Ark and put it out on the open ocean.
Okay, you're talking about the same study and trying to make it sound like a second study. Or at least I can't find any reference to any study related to the seaworthiness of the Ark other than that one Korean study. And that's the one that's cited on the Answers in Genesis article that contains the ridiculous stability comfort strength triangle that you showed while talking about it. And no, that study did not put the scale models on the open ocean. It put them in the Korea Research Institute of Ships and Engineering's large towing tank. And just for reference, a 1/50th scale Noah's Ark would be about 10 feet long. Nowhere near long enough to see if the Ark would suffer the same leaking problem that plagued long wooden ships like the Wyoming.
And like I showed you with those millennials in that study we did, they didn't trust Genesis, right? Over 50% of them had major issues with Genesis. What I didn't show you was that a lot of them also have problems with other parts of the Bible as a result of that. There's other things in the Bible they're not believing either.
And why do you assume that not believing Genesis is the cause of them not believing other parts of the Bible? Do I have to a priori reject the flood in order to find the story of Balaam's talking donkey in the Book of Numbers to be unbelievable? Do I need to reject the Genesis creation story before it's possible to not believe that God literally stopped the earth from turning until Joshua could finish his conquest of a city and then started it back up again when he was done? There are lots of paths to disbelieving the Bible. Genesis being ridiculous is certainly one of them, but it's not even close to the only one.
Okay? In other words, a lot of them think premarital sex is okay. A lot of them think abortion's okay. A lot of them think gay marriage is okay.
And with good reason, because all of those things are okay. And of course, let's not forget that even if we ignore the ritual found in Numbers chapter 5 for aborting the pregnancy of an adulterous woman, 10 to 15% of pregnancies where the person knows they are pregnant end in miscarriage, and it's estimated that around half of all pregnancies end in miscarriage if we include the unknown pregnancies, though for obvious reasons that number's a bit harder to estimate. So given the roughly 140 million babies that are born annually, there are between 15 and 140 million miscarriages every year. Since God is responsible for knitting these babies together in their mother's wombs, according to the common interpretation of that verse in Psalm 139, that means that God is the single most prolific abortion provider in the world. And to make matters worse, he doesn't get consent from the person receiving the abortion before providing it. And that's not even including all of the pregnancies that he messed up, causing a medical abortion to then be necessary, literally having humans clean up after his mistakes, often involving people who were desperately trying to have a baby. So don't pretend to care about unborn babies as if they were fully developed individual people, while the God you worship is responsible for killing way more of them than any of the most in-demand abortion doctors ever could. And then, of course, there's that thought experiment that exposes the hypocrisy here. If an IVF lab were burning down and you were in a room with a canister containing 1,000 embryos and one newborn baby, you can only save one of them. Which one do you save? Everyone with any amount of decency would pick the baby, even though objectively, by the standards that the pro-force birthers are claiming to live by, the canister with 1,000 embryos would be saving more lives.
Little science babies, forgive me. I did not know to feed you liquid nitrogens.
All right, let's talk about the animals. How did Noah fit all those animals on the Ark?
Because Noah was a Time Lord and the Ark was bigger on the inside. Actually, that would make an interesting Doctor Who episode if they haven't already done it. The Doctor goes back in time, sees a flood coming, and somehow ends up saving a bunch of animals that were indigenous to the flooded area that would have gone extinct without his intervention, and when he lets all the animals out, people start telling stories about the guy who packed all these creatures into a tiny wooden box. That makes a lot more sense than the story in the Bible, anyway.
I honestly don't think this would be as much of a question if we actually portrayed the Ark accurately.
No, it still would. I know you guys like to drastically reduce the number of animals necessary on the Ark by appealing to the kinds thing, but the problem there is that to go from the 16,000 animals representing 8,000 kinds that you guys claim to the estimated 6.5 million species of land animals alive today would require rapid evolution far beyond the boundaries that creationists claim evolution has, and on such a large scale that it would leave us wondering, why do creationists oppose the theory of evolution when it's such an integral part of their worldview? And I haven't even gotten into the fact that they believe that all the extinct species were on the Ark as well, like all the dinosaurs. And as long as we're taking Genesis literally, it says that Noah took all the animals that have the breath of life in them. So that's all the marine mammals as well, like whales, dolphins, manatees, etc. And also the labyrinth fish, that's fish with a specialized labyrinth organ that is not quite a lung, but that they use for breathing air. And also all the fish with lungs, like the bashir, which is a type of fish that, even though it has gills and gets most of its oxygen from water, can drown if it doesn't have access to breathable air. And there's probably a bunch of others that I'm forgetting that also breathe air. And of course, let's not forget that there are a number of animals that require more than two members of the species for breeding. There are flies that engage in breeding swarms, birds that will refuse to mate unless they're part of a large flock, colony insects, and more. Not to mention animals that do form breeding pairs but require things like mating competitions in order to get hormone levels to a point where the males are not impotent, or Sumatran rhinos, which rely on communication points in their range that if they can't visit them, they will lose contact with the rest of the rhinos and fail to mate, or animals like koalas that have an incredibly specialized diet where they will only eat eucalyptus leaves from a living eucalyptus tree. Efforts to get them to eat leaves that are not attached to a live tree have failed, as they are apparently too stupid to realize that it's food when it's not in its environmental context. How did Noah get those guys to survive for a year on a boat, and then how did they survive the long journey back to Australia with no eucalyptus trees to be found anywhere? The more you think about Noah's Ark, the bigger the problems get.
Because when we show these cutesy little arcs, it's hard to think about all those animals on there. But when you know how big it really is, right, and its volume is equivalent to nearly 500 semi-trailers, it's a little bit easier to think about how those animals get fit on there. But, just to play devil's advocate here, there are a lot of animals in the world today, right? Most modern estimates would say there's about 8 million species of organisms, both marine and land animals, that includes insects, all of that, in the world today.
Yep, and you go from 8,000 kinds to those 8 million species in the course of 4,000 years. And just to put it in a bit more perspective, to get down to that 8,000 number, they have to say that the kind corresponds approximately to the genus level of taxonomy. And of course, they have to say that it approximately corresponds, because when you look it up, you find that there are about 175,000 extant genuses today. Now, of course, that includes plant, fungi, and chromists, which Noah would have had to have on the Ark as well, but creationists usually like to ignore that or claim that it was easy because he just took seeds or spores or whatever. So let's take them out of the equation altogether. Estimates have the number of terrestrial plant, fungi, and chromist species making up about 14% of the total number of species. So if we assume that the ratio stays approximately the same at the genus level, that leaves us with about 150,000 terrestrial animal genuses that would need to be on the Ark. So that's 300,000 individual animals. And somehow they get that number down to only 8,000 without invoking evolution beyond the kind category while saying kind approximately corresponds to genus? Pull the other one.
But so even with a biblically sized Ark, okay, like we have down at Ark Encounter, think this, only worse, okay? Because that's what, you can't fit 16 million animals on even a biblically sized Ark. It's not going to work.
Yep, that is a true statement. Even a biblically sized Ark is not going to work.
The first one is that Noah, we have to remember, Noah only had to take the land-dwelling, air-breathing animals. He did not have to take the sea creatures because there was plenty of water.
Well, that's one place where you can get the list of animals, sure, but in Genesis chapter 7, verses 13 through 16, we find that Noah brought all animals in which there was the breath of life. So that includes the marine animals I mentioned earlier. It's not an exclusionary all, it's an all-encompassing all. Now, I've had people tell me that I took the breath of life verse out of context because I didn't show that it lists specific animals that it's talking about earlier, but that's not how listing things works. Like, if I were to tell you that I like cookies, I like chocolate chip cookies, I like peanut butter cookies, I like oatmeal raisin cookies, you know what? I like all cookies that are baked in the oven. Would you then conclude from this that I do not like white chocolate macadamia nut cookies because I didn't mention them when I was listing all the cookies that I did like? No, obviously I like those ones as well, because that's what the all that fit in category X at the end of the list is for. So either Noah had whales on the Ark, or else the authors of Genesis were unaware that there were sea creatures that breathe air. And of course, all of this is without even mentioning the fact that AIG always likes to gloss over that the marine animals would have died as a result of the environment suddenly being diluted with all the fresh water of the flood. Unless you want to claim that God miraculously made it rain salt water, in which case all the freshwater critters are dead. Just because it lives in water doesn't mean it can live in any water. That would be like plunking you down on the surface of Titan and then wondering why you couldn't breathe. It's got air, after all, and the pressure is definitely at levels that humans can survive in, so what's the problem? And also, this is completely irrelevant to the video, but when I proposed saltwater rain in the conversation where the creationist was accusing me of taking verses out of context, that was a step too far for him. Yeah, sure. God can break all the laws of physics in order to flood the planet and keep a small wooden boat afloat during that flood, and then somehow magically make evolution happen in a creationist-approved manner that would actually be way too fast for anyone who actually studies evolution to think possible, and make sure that no trace of a genetic bottleneck shows up in any of the animals that were just severely genetically bottlenecked. But raining salt water is just too much to believe.
So if you eliminate the marine species, okay, every marine species from that list, that number is going to drop dramatically, that 8 million.
Not dramatically enough. We're now down to 6.5 million species. And remember, that's extant species. That does not include extinct species that you guys also claim are on the ark. An estimated 99% of all species have gone extinct. So if Noah had all of those guys, and again, we assume that the ratio of land to marine species remains approximately the same, we now have about 650 million species that need to be fit onto the ark.
Insects, we don't really know because they're technically not air breathers. They could survive in other forms outside the ark during the flood.
How are they not technically air breathers? Just because they breathe with a different mechanism doesn't mean they don't breathe. They breathe through spiracles, which directly oxygenate their blood rather than going through a lung organ. But they breathe the breath of life, and if you stop them from breathing, they will die.
But even if he did have to take them, they wouldn't take up a lot of space. But if they didn't have to take them, again, that number is going to drop dramatically. Because marine species and insect species, that's some of the most species we have in the entire world.
And that's literally the end of this part of the answer. She never manages to get it down to the 16,000 animals that AIG likes to claim. She just leaves it as a vague, insects are a lot of species, and they're so small that even if he did have to take them, it'd be fine. Never mind just how many species of insect there are that eat wood, bit of a problem for a wooden boat, but I think this might tie into my earlier observation that she has a hard time actually explicitly lying. She can't quite bring herself to get all the way down to the 16,000 animals because she knows that's impossible, so she just leaves it vague enough that the audience is supposed to be pushed in the direction of drawing that conclusion so that when they see that number later on other AIG materials, they can connect it back to this talk. I don't know, I might be reading too much into it, but it seems suspicious that she wouldn't get all the way to AIG's typical answer to that question.
Next part of the answer, he brought young adults. And when I say Noah brought them, okay, we have to keep in mind, God brought the animals to Noah, Noah then took them on the ark.
Sure, Noah brought the young animals, the ones that are growing the fastest and require the most food. Like, have you seen teenagers eat? They're like little vacuum cleaners, everything just disappears and then they ask for more as if you didn't feed them enough. I'm skipping the rest of this one because it doesn't really help their case. It saves a bit of space, but when you're talking about cramming millions of animals on a boat that can't possibly fit them no matter what size they are, it's a bit of a moot point.
Now, the last point of this I want to spend just a little bit more time on because as a biologist, this is something that's very important to me, and that's that Noah had to take two of each kind, not two of each species, right?
Okay, maybe earlier I gave her too much credit. This must be where we get into the barominology crap, which is where they try to whittle the number down to 16,000 animals. We have to represent approximately 650 million species of terrestrial animals with 8,000 breeding pairs. Somehow you can adequately account for all of these species with a sample that represents 0.001% of them.
It said that the birds after their kind, after their kind, after their kind, two of every kind. Okay, so we see that word. So what is a kind? And most modern biblical creationists would say that kind is the same as family when you talk about modern taxonomy.
When I said genus, I was taking what they have said is the more conservative estimate. But taking it to family doesn't really help all that much. You still end up with the same numbers problem, and the evolution problem becomes even worse. It's the creationist catch-22. If you somehow manage to get the total number of kinds down low enough to fit on the ark, then you have to accept not just evolution, but incredibly unprecedentedly rapid evolution in order to get to the diversity of species that we see today, not to mention all the extinct species that were supposedly also represented on the ark. But if you don't get the total number of kinds down low enough, it becomes not just unfeasible for Noah to take care of them. Let's be real here, there's no way eight people are going to provide adequate care to keep 16,000 animals alive for a year in those conditions. But increase the number of kinds, and it just gets completely absurd in a hurry. Doesn't matter what you do, it doesn't work.
Family is highlighted in blue there because that's where we believe the kind level falls. Now, why do we do that? It's not arbitrary, okay? We just didn't pick it because it's nice.
No, it really is entirely arbitrary, especially considering that those categories are pretty arbitrary, which is why biology is moving away from Linnaean taxonomy toward cladistic taxonomy, where we don't worry so much about what taxonomic category something fits in, we just look at its evolutionary history. And that is not arbitrary, that is data-driven. But stopping at a category in a system that is arbitrary in an attempt to find the beginning of evolution in already significantly evolved organisms, that is arbitrary.
But we picked it because most animals within a family can mate with one another and produce offspring, even if they're different genus and different species.
I mean, if that's true, then it's possible for humans to breed with chimps, gorillas, and orangutans, because that's the family we're in. Unless, of course, you're just making that choice in an arbitrary fashion. Also, worth mentioning is that the Bible flat out says in Leviticus 19:19 that it is possible to breed two different kinds of animals. So, if different kinds of animals can breed with each other, then why are we even using breeding capability as a defining feature for kind in the first place?
Wait a minute. You're saying there were two dogs on the ark, and from the two dogs we get all the different species and breeds that we have today. That seems like a lot of change in only a few thousand years. Okay, well, first of all, it has been a few thousand years, okay?
And this is usually their go-to. Look at how quickly humans bred dogs to become the hundreds of breeds that we know today. That was accomplished in only a few hundred years. But to put this in perspective, assuming that all of the 8,000 species represented on the Ark did not go extinct, which a bunch definitely did, probably about 99% if we're keeping the ratio steady as we have been so far, but assuming they didn't, that means that we need about 6,492,000 new species to evolve between the Ark and today. That's an average of 4 new species every day, continuing to this day. And as Dr. Purdom points out momentarily in a bit that I'm probably going to end up skipping, all dogs are actually the same species. They're even the same species as wolves. So all that evolving to get hundreds of breeds of dogs in a couple hundred years didn't even manage to produce one new species. But we're supposed to believe that since the Ark landed, there have been 1,600 new species evolving every year? And remember, evolution happens mostly at the population level. You need to have a good-sized population of a species, which are then separated from other members of that species somehow, thereby allowing one group to evolve in a different direction than the others. In the case of dogs, humans were doing the separating much faster than nature ever could. But putting that aside, evolution would not have been able to start right away because all of these species would need to recover from the severe bottleneck event that they just suffered. You need to re-establish a breeding population of animals first before you can have a segment of that population get separated from the others. Oh, also, AIG believes that there was an ice age right after the flood, so add in a bunch of weather-related hardship for all of these animals that are supposed to be thriving to a point where new species just pop out left and right. Not to mention the hardships endured as they travel back to the lands from which they came, all without any plants that they rely to live on. Yeah, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. The Ark does not work.
We did the research on that to take all living animals and all animals only known from the fossil record and classify them into their original kinds. Okay, that's a huge undertaking, but we did that. And so what we came up with is mammals and another group that's totally extinct called non-mammalian synapsids. We have about 550 kinds. For birds, we have a little under 300 kinds. For reptiles, a little over 300 kinds. And then amphibians, about 250 kinds, which gives us a grand total of about 1,400 kinds, or right around 7,000 animals.
For the record, the 8,000 kinds number that I've been using is from Answers in Genesis. The link is in the description if you want to check it out, but that doesn't really matter. Mainly what I want to point out here is that creationists will often complain whenever something scientific gets revised. Hey, in the 1800s, the Earth was 100 million years old. In the early 1900s, it was 1 billion years old. Now it's 4 billion years old. Can't they make up their minds? Well, here the creationists are, having extremely different estimates for how many animals would have been on the Ark within just a few years of each other. The article I got the 8,000 number from was published in 2013, and this video was published in 2019, so in just 6 short years, the number of kinds shrank down to a fifth of what it was before. And of course, you ignored the insects. Why do you ignore the insects? They are super important for pretty much any ecosystem, and they would not have been able to survive a year-long worldwide flood. It's because they're incredibly problematic for your story, isn't it? So you just arbitrarily declare that since their system of breathing is different from ours, they don't have the breath of life, so they didn't get a ride on the boat. Though, honestly, even if we ignore the breath of life thing, I would have thought that the creepy crawlies would have counted in the creeping things part of the list that you quoted earlier.
Okay, so then that's definitely an overestimate, okay? It probably was less than that, but we're being generous.
You divide the total number of kinds by 5 from your previous estimate, and then say that that's an overestimate? Give me a break.
People say, okay, that's nice, but what did T-Rex eat? Okay, because he's a carnivore. Well, I think there's two possibilities. One, all they were given was fruits and veggies, so to speak, or grain. They had a vegetarian diet for a period of time. This is about surviving. It's not about what they want.
The thing is, though, there are animals that are what is known as obligate carnivores. Cats are the go-to example for that. If you feed a cat, and this is any cat, big, small, medium, wild, domestic, doesn't matter, if you feed that cat a vegetarian diet, it will get sick and die. Their digestive tracts do not have the ability to absorb certain necessary nutrients from plant matter, so they need to get that from eating meat. So yeah, it's not about the cat wanting meat. Plenty of cats are happy to eat the vegetarian stuff. My cat actually kind of has a thing for muffins, oddly enough. It's about the cat needing meat to survive. So no, the animals on the Ark could not all have been eating nothing but fruits, vegetables, and grains. And that's actually it for this one. This is the first half of their video. I'll cover the second half at a later date. Today's comment of the day comes to us from 420 Atheist, who says, God wants a relationship, but in like a shitty dad kind of way. One that went for milk and we're still waiting on his return. Well, now I'm sad because I'm picturing all the Christians as little kids looking out the window saying, Daddy will be back any minute now. He just went for milk. But like 2,000 years ago is when he went for milk. Thanks for watching. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, DJ, Michael, and all the rest, who are the whales swimming their way onto the Ark that is my channel. If you'd like to sink the whole Noah story, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects, like The Watering Hole, and it's also where you'll find links to the model files that I use in my background, so if you want to print any of those for yourself, that's where to go for those. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!